Coming up on the My Ag Life Daily News Report, we get details on funding in the state budget for drought relief, and we hear from a new member of the U.S. Senate Ag Committee. We also have today's news brief, but we start today with My Ag Life in Citrus. And for today's Citrus segment, we take a look at citrus here and around the nation. Looking around the state first, the CDFA is currently accepting proposals for 8 contractors to serve as grower liaisons for several regions or counties throughout the state. As an integral partner in the fight against Wonglong Bean and the Asian Citrus Psyllid, responsibilities of grower liaisons may include conducting outreach directly to growers in the designated counties or regions, providing up-to-date information on the latest industry news or regulatory updates, staying engaged in CDFA activities, communicating voluntary or mandatory treatments throughout the area, and more. Proposals for all positions are now being accepted through May 10th. Grower liaison positions are open in Fresno and Madera counties, Kern County, Northern Tulare County, Southern Tulare County, Northern Ventura County, Southern Ventura County, San Bernardino County, and San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties. For more information, you can visit the CDFA website. Looking beyond California, the USDA is asking residents of South Texas to watch for the Mexican fruit fly. Texas's lower Rio Grande Valley produces more than 9 million cartons of fresh grapefruit and oranges each year, making it one of the United States' top citrus areas. USDA and Texas Department of Agriculture employees are inspecting fruit trees in residential yards and commercial properties in several counties there in search of fruit flies. They tell residents if they ask to inspect the trees on the property, please let them. They're following all Centers for Disease Control health guidelines and will have official credentials identifying them as USDA or state employees. Coming back to the Golden State, the California State Senate Budget and Fiscal Review Subcommittee is scheduled to meet again today, and one of the items on the agenda is a discussion on the Senate Agriculture Budget Plan. At a previous meeting last Thursday, funding for water and drought relief was detailed. Ag groups praised the $300 million for grants related to the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act and $250 million for water use efficiency grants. Here's audio from that meeting and details on the funding.
Please proceed with the presentation on the Senate budget plan on drought and safe drinking water.
Thank you, Senator and members. Nice to see you. Good afternoon. Rachel Ehlers with the Legislative Analyst's Office. If I could, I'll just make a couple quick comments ahead before we talk about the package more generally on drought. We know that there is a package that you are discussing today, but we also know that the negotiations will continue and discussions will continue. So just a few points we think you might want to keep in mind as those discussions continue. First, as the administration presented, things are looking pretty bad thus far hydrologically. So one of the big lessons we learned during the last drought is thinking about being proactive rather than reactive. We are lucky that we have these lessons learned, a silver lining, I guess, of what we went through a few years ago. So it's great that we're having this discussion today and really thinking strategically about what we can do to get ahead of conditions worsening. If you look at that chart on page 26 of your agenda, you'll see we did spend $3.4 billion over that four-year period during the last drought and drought response. But you'll see that the bulk of it was in that first category, water supply, that was mostly supported by bonds. And those are mostly longer-term projects. So they really didn't respond to that the last drought because bonds take a while to get out the door, the projects take a while to finance and permit. And so hopefully those will help us in this new drought that we're facing. But as you think about your package, thinking about balancing kind of immediate near-term response to pressing situations as compared to longer-term resilience, both are important, but those bigger longer-term projects won't necessarily address immediate needs. And that also leads to considerations about funds source. As I mentioned, you know, we used mostly bond monies for those big projects last time. Those take a while. We really did rely on general fund and in some cases special funds for some of those immediate emergency response, water conservation, environmental protection activities you see in that chart. Another important thing to think about is balancing the human needs of drought impacts as well as the environmental needs. The state is responsible for managing public trust resources, including fish and wildlife and waterways. and those had some pretty significant impacts during the last drought. So making sure as you're thinking about constructing any funding package, you're thinking about both of those categories of need. And then even within the human needs, thinking about in particular vulnerable communities. During the last drought, as was mentioned, rural farm worker communities really experienced some very significant impacts, not only from loss of drinking water, but also economic impacts from loss of jobs, from agricultural production slowdowns. So thinking about how the state can help those target aid to those who might need it most. And then finally, we think it's important to note, we put out a report about 2 weeks ago on the state appropriations limit, which is a kind of a new complicating factor, as if our state budget process wasn't complicated enough. Now we've got a new factor that probably is going to come into play and place some constraints on state spending and state general fund spending, proceeds of taxes, not only in the coming budget, but in the coming years. So it's pretty technical, and we could have a long conversation about it. I'm happy to answer any questions if members have it, but we just want to have that on your radar as you're thinking about a package, that there is the kind of this new level of complication. And there are some things that count towards the limit and some types of expenditures that don't count. So we're happy to work with you as you work through your overall budget package. But that's just another issue to have on your radar.
I have that copy of it on my desk, and I have cracked the seal on it, but it was it's special reading. So before we get into it, you know, basically, if you take out the bond money from 2013 to 2017, for those 4 years, we spent something north of $1 billion over every year, over the 4 years, which is a quarter of $1 billion. This is if you take out the money to the water districts for the federal funding, but we're putting together federal funds, general funds, and then any scrapes of money that's left from the bonds, you know, 68 and one. So this is real money. This is not, you know, we're going to finance it. So that's, you give me some idea of the impact of spending $250 million a year and then $2.5 billion now, or, you know, about. That's 10 times as much for all these things that the administration has pointed out that were sort of lessons learned. I mean, it seems like a good idea.
There are certainly needs, and again, acting early ahead of when conditions worsen. I think, again, emphasizing how many of the activities you want to fund are kind of immediate and will make a big difference in the next year or two versus how many will make a difference in the subsequent drought. Both are important. It's just thinking about what are the areas of focus. And even if you put another important consideration is, even if you put a lot of funding out in 1 year, that doesn't necessarily mean it will all be spent in that year, particularly for some of the longer term projects. So it's balancing kind of that immediate need, a longer term need, and also what types of activities can be implemented on a quick basis versus that will take longer.
Okay. All right. Well, that's it. Those are three general ideas to keep in mind on drought. Why don't you proceed with the main attraction?
Great. So yes, staff have asked us to present the proposal before you. Just want to reiterate, this is not an LAO proposal or an LAO package. We are just simply serving as your staff to present. So if there are specific questions members have about the package, probably best to direct them towards committee members or staff, but I'm happy to present. So the package before you is $3.41 billion in one-time state and federal funds, and I'll go through at a high level the categories. There's $500 million for immediate community assistance for water and drought relief, $500 million for emergency drought water use efficiency projects, $350 million for sustainable groundwater management. That would be grants to implement the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, SGMA, as well as for some other groundwater-related activities. $200 million for resilient water infrastructure projects. $200 million for recycled water projects. $200 million for stormwater management. $285 million for various activities that would help protect fish and wildlife from drought impacts. $100 million for water quality activities. $75 million for various activities to improve water data and forecasting. And then $1 billion in federal funds to help ratepayers, community water systems, wastewater treatment works, and public utilities recover from the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. And then finally, the package also includes language to accelerate appropriation of existing water bond priorities from Proposition 1 and Proposition 68, where funds are available and demand is high, and also to urge the Water Commission to convene and reallocate $145 million in existing Proposition 1 funds that were originally set aside for the Temperance Flat Dam to use for other sustainable water storage investments in the Central Valley.
Yeah, and we should be clear that that is just... is a suggestion for the members of the water board when they reconvene. It's not it's not to be interpreted as a budget item per se. We know that there's money sitting there.
As mentioned, the budget discussion does continue in the state legislature. Video of that full meeting is available on the state Senate website. Our news brief is coming up next. We'll be right back.
The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Here's your news brief for today. The Interior Department announced that the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, has given final approval to a new solar energy project on public lands in California. The Crimson Solar Project represents an investment of roughly $550 million and has the potential to deliver enough power to energize about 87,500 homes. The record of decision authorizes Sonoran West to construct a 350-megawatt solar photovoltaic facility with a 350-megawatt energy storage system and the necessary support facilities to generate and deliver power through the Southern California Edison Colorado River substation. The Agriculture Department recently announced an increased enrollment cap and new and expanded incentives within its Conservation Reserve program. Rod Bain explains.
The Agriculture Department's Conservation Reserve Program is one of its longest-running conservation offerings, established as part of the 1985 Farm Bill. And recently, USDA announced an expansion within CRP's suite of offerings and incentives to eligible landowners. Farm Service Agency Administrator Zach Duchenau says among the changes, an increase in the CRP enrollment cap from 25 to 27 million acres by the year 2023.
We're currently 4 million acres below our goal for 2021. So we're really challenged with how do we get folks interested enough to enroll or re-enroll their land in the program.
Such encouragement comes in the form of higher rental rates and increased incentives.
What we're really aiming at is to increase payments for proactive incentive rates for continuous CRP from 20 to 50%, and soil rental per acre may also increase as well. That's going to be on a more case-by-case basis. We also want to increase payments for water quality practices from 10 to 20% and do this through the continuous CRP sign-up.
In addition,
we're also looking at establishing a CRP grassland minimum rental rate that will provide benefits to more than 1,300 counties with rates that are currently below the minimum that we're contemplating.
Much of this focus also centers on incentivizing climate-smart agriculture practices, including a new, specific climate-smart ag incentive inside CRP.
Establishment of trees, permanent grasses. Development of wildlife habitat is hand in hand with climate smart agriculture, because the more diversity you have in your ecosystem, the better your practices are for the environment on a grander scale.
Additional changes include moving state acres for wildlife enhancement safe program practices to the CRP continuous sign-up and expansion of the Clear 30 watershed and prairie pothole soil health programs. Also, USDA will invest $10 million in the CRP monitoring, assessment, and evaluation program to measure and monitor soil carbon and climate resilience impacts of CRP acreage over the life of new CRP contracts. Data collected through the May program will help USDA refine producer-based climate-resilient tools and practices. More details are available through local FSA offices or online at www.farmers.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
From the California Farm Bureau, this is the busiest time of year for beekeepers who breed and sell queen bees to help replenish honeybee colonies. And the breeders say the drought may lead to additional demand. Dry weather reduces the amount of forage available to bees, meaning beekeepers could need to buy more queens to restock hives. Bee breeders say demand for new queens has been so intense that they've had to turn away prospective customers. The Secretary of Agriculture used Earth Day last month to highlight USDA's efforts aimed at mitigating climate and encouraging conservation. Here's Stephanie Ho.
On Earth Day, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack added support to President Biden's climate summit by pointing out what USDA is doing.
We recently announced the expansion of our CRP program, our Conservation Reserve program, looking forward to adding 4 million acres to that program. Those 4 million acres will allow us to essentially store 3.6 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent, prevent 90 million pounds of nitrogen entering into our waterways, and ensuring that 33 million tons of sediment and topsoil are preserved for productive agriculture.
At the same time, he also announced a $330 million investment in 85 rural conservation partnership projects.
In 45 states and over 8 critical conservation areas, this resource will help to leverage and attract an additional $400 million into these projects with a focus on drought relief, enhanced soil health, and expansion of wildlife habitat.
The third announcement involves conservation innovation grants.
$25 million, which will be focused on innovation trials, a significant percentage of that will be invested in soil health practices. And in addition, rural development will also announce today a $487 million investment in a wide variety of projects,
which include hundreds of millions of dollars of investment in infrastructure for renewable energy and biofuels, as well as rural water and wastewater.
These resources will essentially allow us to aggressively begin a process over the next 4 years of investing in a variety of projects and activities focused on making the best utilization of the climate opportunity that we have.
The Ag Secretary pointed out that this is in line with the president's goals,
which calls for additional resources in these areas, as well as the American Jobs Plan, a concerted effort to address the importance of climate change, to invest in climate smart agricultural practices.
At President Biden's climate summit, one announcement involved plans to launch the Agriculture Innovation Mission for Climate, or AIM for Climate, which will be fleshed out at international meetings this year. After it is officially launched, AIM for Climate will catalyze greater investment in agricultural research and innovation to help support transformative climate action in all countries. Meanwhile, at home, USDA has been actively working on public outreach.
I can assure you there's no intention to have a land grab. There's no intention to take something away from folks. It's really designed to figure out creative and innovative ways to encourage folks to participate in what I think many farmers and ranchers are already doing and may very well be inclined to do more if the right set of incentives are in place.
So he concluded, a new situation presents new opportunities.
Looking forward to continuing the conversation and discussion as we identify ways in which we can improve our capacity to meet the climate change challenge, while at the same time creating new revenue and income opportunities for farmers, ranchers, and producers in a way that makes our food and agriculture industry more sustainable economically and environmentally.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Another story from the California Farm Bureau. The leftovers from winemaking could eventually be repurposed as a food supplement or other product. Researchers at the University of California, Davis, studied the grape skins, seeds, and other residue left after grapes had been crushed for wine. Analysis of the residue shows it contains health-enhancing compounds and particular sugar molecules that researchers said could be developed into products to benefit human health. That's our news brief for today. We hear from a new member of the U.S. Senate Agriculture Committee right after this.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Senator Cory Booker was recently named to the Senate Ag Committee and addressed agricultural journalists at our conference last week. Booker is a New Jersey Democrat, a vegan, and one of the lead authors of the Black Farmer provisions included in the American Rescue Plan. He's also one of the decision makers on the Senate Ag Committee. Here are his opening statements to the group.
It's just such an honor to be able to sit with reporters and editors who write about food and agricultural issues. And I'll tell you, I just want to thank you for the work you do. I know that so many benefit from your expertise and your commitment to truth telling. And that's what I want to spend a little bit of time talking about, really telling just plainly why I joined the Agricultural Committee, and then talk about my near-term priorities on that committee of adjusting climate change, dealing with what I think is a broad-scale nutrition crisis, and a little bit about my work for disadvantaged farmers. But my journey is one that's not an obvious one to the Senate Agricultural Committee, but it began in a place many people might not think such an ag journey would begin, which is in the city of Newark, New Jersey. I still live there today. And actually, I think I'm the only senator in America that goes home to an inner city, majority black and brown, majority low income community. In my community, we don't mistake wealth with worth. We are a community that is rich with so many things. But according to the 2010 census, the median income in my neighborhood was about $14,000. So when I became mayor of the city, the vast majority of Newark, unfortunately, as many inner cities are, was considered a food desert, which, you know, that means that most of my residents didn't have access to healthy and nutritious food options. So my administration went to work. We were able to attract supermarkets to build and open in the city for the first time in a generation, including a ShopRite and a Whole Foods. We provided grants to local corner stores or bodegas so that they could purchase refrigeration equipment for fruits and vegetables. And we started growing more food in our city, from small community gardens to multi-acre urban farms, giving people jobs on those farms. And then we took the food and distributed it to farm stands and farmers markets around the city. But it was very clear to me from the beginning that the scale of the problem we were confronting was far too big for any one city to fix. And in Newark, like so many communities around the country, we had not only a crisis when it came to accessing healthy food, but we had a severe nutrition crisis as well. I got into the Senate and I began traveling around my state and around America. And what I saw glaringly clear was that we in the United States of America have a savagely broken food system that is failing all of us. In my travels, I've seen a food system that is broken for American farmers and ranchers who are being squeezed from all sides by multinational corporations with near monopolistic power, starting from their seed suppliers all the way through to the marketplace where they sell their animals into. I've sat down with farmers and ranchers, independents, Democrats, Republicans, all of those farmers and ranchers, and I've heard their stories. Stories from cattlemen who told me that they used to have dozens of different buyers for their animals, but due to the unchecked corporate consolidation, they now only have a few or just one buyer. I've seen how the food system is broken for food workers, from food chain workers forced to literally risk their lives, crowded into meat packing plants that became hotbeds for COVID-19 outbreaks, to farm workers forced to work outdoors in close proximity to awful, toxic chemicals none of us would want to see used in or around our children or families. I've seen how the food system is so, so broken for America's rural communities who are forced to live near massive manure lagoons, making life miserable for their neighbors who have their clean air and clean water taken from them by these large factory farms. I've seen a food system that is definitely broken for farm animals, with billions of animals each year treated with such immense cruelty that we're all forced to look away rather than to admit the kind of horror that many of these animals are facing every single day. I've seen a food system where millions and millions of our fellow Americans suffer from a hunger crisis or a nutrition crisis or both. I've seen a food system which can be part of the solution, though. I've had optimism and hope grow in my mind that how every major issue we are facing in America touches our food systems, from climate change and its serious need to reduce emissions to the abundant possibilities that can exist for our children. Along this journey, I also learned the ugly history of discrimination in the USDA against socially disadvantaged farmers that have caused, in particular, black farmers to lose millions of acres of land, billions and billions of dollars of value over the last century. This is overall a vast broken system that simply does not affect American values. And so I joined the Ag Committee, and I believe that there is a national movement growing to bring about transformative change to our food and farm system, to create a more just system that reins in corporate power, levels the playing field, creates a more vibrant free market, creates a food system that aligns with our American values, not the perversion that we see too often now. And so I want to do my best as a United States Senator, as a member of the Ag Committee, to do that. And so now the system I described to you wasn't just created yesterday. It's been created over decades, and transforming it will neither be easy nor quick. But there are areas that I'm going to be focusing on, and I'd like to talk to you about them very quickly. First, I want to discuss the once-in-a-generation opportunity we currently have to transition tens of millions of acres, perhaps even hundreds of millions of acres, to more regenerative agricultural practices. Our nation's farmers and ranchers are on the front lines of the climate crisis, and they can be some of our greatest partners and leaders in finding climate solutions. Natural climate solutions, such as planting trees, restoring wetlands, and investing in practices that increase soil health, are some of our most effective and enduring tools against climate change. Existing USDA programs already provide financial and technical assistance to farmers and ranchers to implement effective ground-tested practices. And these practices are starving for funding and are so oversubscribed. Along with Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, I recently introduced the Climate Stewardship Act, which would invest billions of new dollars every year into these voluntary USDA conservation programs to help American farmers make their agricultural operations a part of the climate solution. And so to be specific real quick, my bill would incrementally increase mandatory funding for both CSP and EQIP to $7 billion per year for a period of 10 years and would dedicate that new funding specifically to climate stewardship practices. Importantly, it would set aside 5% of this additional funding for socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers and another 5% for beginning farmers and ranchers. It would also expand the Conservation Reserve Program to 40 million acres by 2030, with nearly all of the new acres enrolled to be the most marginal environmentally sensitive acres of land. The Climate Stewardship Act would double funding for climate-related agricultural research, as well as triple funding for the conservation technical assistance programs. And to boost energy efficiency and renewable energy projects in rural America, my bill would increase funding for Rural Energy for America program to $3 billion per year for 10 years. These investments that are needed are big, but so is the challenge of our climate crisis. Scientists have made clear about the urgency and scale with which we must act, and it's critical that we adequately invest in American farmers and ranchers. And by dramatically increasing these fundings in these programs, they can be our heroes in this crisis. We have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to take bold, ambitious action and fully invest in America's farmers and rural communities to work together to solve the greatest threat facing our planet. And so I'm calling for new funding of $20 billion per year for the next 10 years in the upcoming infrastructure and climate package to center our farmers and ranchers and the natural climate solutions outlined in my bill as part of the solution to climate change. Included in that amount would be funding to do like FDR did, to plant billions of trees, including 100 million urban trees, to counteract heat island impacts in low-income communities and communities of color like the one I live in Newark, New Jersey. And not only these investments, the right thing to do for the planet, but they can transform rural and urban communities, improve the quality of the water we drink and the air we breathe, increase, very importantly, farmers' bottom lines, improve their crop yields, bolster biodiversity and wildlife habitat, and make farms more resilient to the impacts of climate change. Now, the second area where I see a prospect for near-term progress and where we've already made strides is the quest to achieve justice for socially disadvantaged farmers. At the end of the last Congress, as was said in my introduction, I introduced the Justice for Black Farmers Act in an attempt to comprehensively address the well and painfully documented history of discrimination by the USDA against specifically targeted black farmers. After I introduced the bill, I made it a top priority to try to get debt forgiveness enacted into law as quickly as possible, because I knew that after suffering decades of discrimination by the USDA, the black farmers who had somehow managed to hold on were hit in a severe way by COVID-19 that weakened them financially. So earlier this year, working with Reverend Warnock and Senator Warnock and Chairwoman Stabenow and Chairman Scott, we were able to get the FSA debt forgiveness for farmers of color, along with an additional $1 billion of assistance included in the COVID-19 relief bill. Now that Congress has passed this law and provided this funding to the USDA, I believe the USDA should make the loan payments happen as quickly as possible, without delay. And while this is a historic first step towards the justice for black farmers, there's just a lot more work to do. Now, the last topic I want to discuss with you is nutrition. Currently, we are in a stunning crisis that most Americans don't realize. Half of our population in America is pre-diabetic or has type 2 diabetes. Even more shocking, 1/4 of our teenagers are pre-diabetic or have type 2 diabetes. And the numbers are even worse in the black and brown communities. In just the last decade alone, diabetes rates have tripled for Native American children, doubled for Black children, and increased 50% amongst Latinx children. These kinds of disease rates are astounding and were unimaginable just two generations ago. And when you drill down even more, you see more pain and wretchedness in our nutrition crisis. Black Americans, for example, are 40% more likely to have high blood pressure and 30% more likely to die of heart disease than their white peers. Ron Finley, this great Black activist, talked about how in South Central Los Angeles, there are drive-throughs and drive-bys. And quote, the drive-throughs are killing more people than the drive-bys. It doesn't have to be like this. We are currently subsidizing this tragic system. We are subsidizing easy access to the foods that are high in calories but have minimal nutritional value and that are literally killing us. While at the same time, many communities, primarily low-income communities and communities of color, lack access to healthy foods they need to thrive. People in communities like mine know what it's like to go to that corner grocery store and find a Twinkie product cheaper than a fruit. Those Twinkie-like products being cheaper than fruit. Yet while the federal government tells us that our plates should largely consist of fruits and vegetables, less than 2% of our federal ag subsidies go to these healthy foods. Meanwhile, as big agricultural conglomerates get richer and bigger from this system, our family farmers are continuing to struggle, getting less and less of the share of the consumer dollar. In the year I was born, 1969, President Nixon convened the White House Conference on Food and Nutrition to address the urgent national concern of malnutrition in America. What resulted was an unprecedented expansion and creation of vital programs, including WIC, to tackle the hunger crisis. Fast forward my lifetime, and we are grappling with a hunger crisis that we now face. We're seeing really the second great food crisis in America, one of nutrition insecurity, where too many Americans are overfed but undernourished. As we continue to pour massive federal subsidies into a broken system that is literally making us sick, causing us to spend increasing amounts of taxpayer dollars on healthcare costs to treat chronic diet-related diseases. Despite being the wealthiest nation in the world, we have created a food system and nutrition system that is impoverishing us all. And so I believe we must urgently rethink the way we approach food and nutrition policy. And I am joining the call for the second White House Conference on Food, Nutrition, and Health that convenes public and private stakeholders to reimagine federal food and nutrition policy. I also believe that we need to create a permanent USDA specialty crop food box program that pays a fair price to our farmers and delivers fresh fruits and vegetables to communities across our country like mine in Newark, where they are in desperate need for healthy produce. As you know, I am chairman now of the Subcommittee on Nutrition and Specialty Crops, and I'm bringing it. I'm going to bring a focus on food justice and the nutrition crisis that is sending generations of our elders to an early death and robbing our children of too much of their precious potential. I'll be spending my time and energy on these priorities and many more on that committee, and I look forward to engaging with you all as we step it up to bring justice to our food system.
Senator Cory Booker. Coming up, we wrap up the session on underserved farmers and hear from the head of a national Latino Farmers Association. We'll be right back.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease.
ProMax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRight Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/ProMax for more information.
At the North American Agricultural Journalists Association conference last week, there was a panel discussion on underserved farmers. Rudy Arredondo is the president and CEO of the National Latino Farmers and Ranchers Trade Association and was one of the panel speakers. He said infrastructure is a concern for his members.
One of the things that we have a concern of is in terms of the lack of a infrastructure that is, the, you know, we have tremendous need for broadband. And it's very difficult when the government agencies are requiring you to submit paperwork through the portals. First of all, a farmer is not a technician, so it's very difficult for them to be able to submit that. And then with the pandemic, we've had not only lack of access to the rural broadband, but also we've had technical aspects. You know, our markets went away. Hotels, schools, even our farmers market, we had to pretty much stop. So we're working on a national infrastructure bank proposal that was introduced by Representative Danny Davis from Illinois. It's HR 6422, and we are extremely concerned with regard to making sure that especially now that Senator Booker, and we have Senator Ben Ray Lujan from New Mexico. We also work very closely with Senator Bob Menendez from New Jersey. We are very, very concerned and interested in making sure that our infrastructure comes up to good working order according to the Society of Civil Engineers.
He also gave a brief history of the organization and discussed why it was formed.
We were founded in 2005 in Las Cruces, New Mexico. At our initial focus were farm workers that had transitioned into farm ownership. That was due to my background. You know, my parents were migrant farm workers, and we traveled with them throughout the United States following the crops. And so, you know, we traveled from Texas. After we left school in late May or early May, whenever school was over, and then we would start traveling throughout. Moved through East Texas to El Campo, Warden, Navasota, then from there on to West Ohatchee. Then in the fall we would be up in the West Texas, Lubbock, Leveland, Brownfield, and then move on to Arizona. We never went to California because we found out that they had more than enough farm workers to be able to carry out the crops, to harvest crops. So my family, we would go to Oregon, Washington State, then come down to Idaho, Minnesota for sugar beets, and down to Michigan to pick cherries. And then finally wind up in Ohio, which was the last stop for several years, and for the harvest of tomatoes. And that's where my family settled out. They settled out in northwestern Ohio near Toledo, a little town called Wazion, and where we, to this day, farmed, and we bought a farm there. And now my brothers and my sisters, there's eight of us all together. The younger ones, they're farming. They have seven small family farms in the northwestern Ohio area, Lucas County, was in the Fulton, Henry, and Williams County. So that's our background. The Latino Farmers and Ranchers, you know, we are now 75,000 is our membership. We represent, we're the only Latino farmer and rancher organization, and we represent over 75,000 Latino farmers and ranchers throughout the United States. This is the first time that we've ever gotten national attention. So I appreciate you journalists, you get it. We own 32 million acres, and we generate over almost $22 billion in sales. So it's not insignificant. However, like I said, you know, we don't, and we're not looking at, you know, we're not looking for, you know, being a media sensation, far from that. Our interest is in terms of how can we fix our food system from farm to table. We have a significant amount of barriers, one of which is that the Department of Agriculture is not very well positioned for information dissemination.
Dr. Lakeisha Odom, the Scientific Program Director for the Foundation for Food and Agriculture Research, discussed the diverse makeup of farmers in America.
But there is still a wide range of diversity that often is not captured. Even when you're thinking about the prevalent stereotypes of the American farmer, they fail to capture that realistic picture of the diversity in the community. And when we think about that collective vision of today's agriculture, Black, Latinx, Asian American, Native farmers, Hispanic farmers are largely missing from this vision. And so, again, as I mentioned, and I believe that our previous panelists mentioned, while there are more than 2 million farms in the U.S., fewer than 2% are Black operated, and 88% of Black farmers do live primarily in 12 Southern states. And while these farms are operated, they tend to be of smaller size and they have a lower net farm income than their white counterpart. And again, this is due to long-term exclusion of market systems like Jim Crow, everything that's been mentioned previously in this panel.
That is our show for today. If you have a topic you'd like to discuss, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.